from WBUR in Boston. I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. Coming to an NFL city near you, Blackout 2010. Ahead on Only a Game, how flagging ticket sales have caused some teams to disappear from the nation's flat screens. Also, a Ryder Cup update from Wales, a look at recent effects of Title IX legislation on men's college sports programs, and we appreciate the sports writing of John Lardner. Also, NBA Hall of Famer and artist Tommy Heinsohn blurs the lines between basketball and brushstrokes.
Look at Van Gogh. During his lifetime, he sold one painting, and I think it was to his brother. He's the type of guy that would be willing to take the last shot of a game. Last shot by Van Gogh. Give him three!
Stay tuned.
Major funding for Only a Game comes from Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com.
This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The days of baseball's regular season are dwindling down to a precious few. Last night, the Padres beat the Giants 6-4 to keep San Diego's hopes for a division title alive. They trailed San Francisco by 2 games with 2 to play. In other National League action, the Braves fell to the Phillies. They now have a 1-game lead in the wild card race over the Padres. In the American League, Tampa Bay fell half a game behind the Yankees in the East by losing to the Royals, while New York was rained out. The Yankees are scheduled to play 2 against the Red Sox in Boston today and tonight. The 2010 Ryder Cup is underway at Celtic Manor Resort in Newport, Wales. Golf's biannual tournament pitting teams from the U.S. and Europe against one another began yesterday morning, then stopped because of torrential rains, then started again in the afternoon. Play was stopped again because of darkness, and they finally completed the first round of 4 balls this morning. The USA leads Europe 2.5 to 1.5. Sports Illustrated senior writer Alan Shipnuck is in Wales covering the Ryder Cup, and he joins me now. Alan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks for having me.
For those who don't follow the sport of golf closely, give us a quick overview of the 3 formats played in the Ryder Cup.
The first day featured only the 4 balls. That's where there's two-man teams. Each guy plays his own ball, and whichever score from his team carries the hole. The alternate shot, or as they're called, foursomes over here, there's only 1 ball in play for each team, and as you can imagine, they alternate shot. And then for the final round, hopefully Sunday, possibly Monday, there'll be 12 singles matches, man against man, very simple. But I think it's going to come down to the singles, and it could come down to the last few matches. The teams look very evenly matched so far.
The 2010 course at Celtic Manor, designed just for the Ryder Cup, was drenched in Friday's downpours. Even when play resumed, the grounds crew still was out there with squeegees on the greens before these guys could putt. How much did the weather affect the quality of play?
Well, tremendously, especially during the early going before they stopped it for 7 hours. The air was so thick and wet with the rain falling that the players were saying they were losing, 20% on their yardages. The rough was saturated and virtually unplayable. So it's a shame because it's almost predictable. You come to Wales in October, it's going to rain. And they built this course basically in a floodplain at the bottom of a valley. I mean, it's a bog out there. What do they expect?
Sounds a little bit like the baseball equivalent would be building Candlestick Park in San Francisco.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, these are outdoor sports. Go where the sunshine is.
The U.S. team thought that they were prepared for the wet weather of Wales, but I guess their Ryder Cup rain gear was more water-absorbent than water-repellent, as it turned out.
Oh, yeah, that was such a delicious story. Lisa Pavin, the so-called captainess, the wife of U.S. Ryder Cup captain Corey Pavin, has made a big deal of the team uniforms, and she's tried to make them very fashion-forward. She had unlimited budget and seemed to exhaust it. They have every permutation of periwinkle cardigan and pinstripe pants you can imagine, but the most single most important thing you could have is rain gear that works. And within half an hour of play starting, the players were drenched and complaining about it. And someone took their corporate card, went into the merchandise pavilion and had to pay retail for all the overpriced logoed apparel that the fans are snapping up. And they bought a bunch of rain gear right off the rack. And I can assure you that it brightened up the rain delay for all the press here.
Golf trash talk is usually pretty tame by sports standards. However, European team member Rory McIlroy recently said that with Tiger Woods not playing at his best, he would love to face Woods in the Ryder Cup. When asked about that, Woods said, "Yeah, me too." Does this kind of thing have any impact once play begins?
Well, it will on young Rory if he does happen to get Tiger in singles, because he gets butt kicked. I mean, the last thing you want to do is give Tiger extra motivation. But to answer your question, the Ryder Cup is not normal golf. It's very heated. It's very passionate. It's very emotional, jingoistic. Guys do things that they normally wouldn't this week. They just get swept up in the fever of it all. There's always some bruised feelings at the end of the Ryder Cup week.
The rain canceled the first day's afternoon foursomes. What's the plan for making up the golf that didn't get played yesterday?
It's complicated, but basically they're adding extra matches to the different sessions to try and speed things up. The doomsday scenario, you know, the nuclear option is that if this thing is not done Monday at 6:43, which is the sundown here locally, then the Ryder Cup is over. Any matches that haven't been completed are declared a have, no matter what, and they'll add up the points and declare a winner. And whichever team loses is going to be really bitter because they will not have had a full chance.
The U.S. won the 2008 Ryder Cup, but the Europeans have won five of the last seven tournaments. Who do you like this time around?
Well, I've been picking the U.S. for a month, mostly to be a contrarian because everyone was picking Europe. But because of the quirks, the qualifying system, the Europeans had to leave off two of their best players, and Paul Casey and Justin Rose. And their best player, Lee Westwood, got hurt and wasn't able to play for 6 weeks leading up to it. And don't forget, the U.S. has four of the top five players in the world rankings. Tiger Woods, Phil Mickelson, Jim Furyk, Steve Stricker. I mean, they can carry the team if they're playing their best. So I think it's going to be close, but I still like the U.S. to do it.
Alan Shipnuck is a senior writer for Sports Illustrated, and he co-authored Swinging from My Heels with Christina Kim. Alan, thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This weekend, fans of the Raiders and the Chargers will be looking for alternative fare on their TV screens. As the slumping economy has made it more difficult for teams to sell out games, the number of TV blackouts has increased. Last year, 22 NFL games were not broadcast in their local markets. Fans in Oakland and Jacksonville were the ones most often inconvenienced. But this year, slow ticket sales are provoking blackouts in other NFL cities for the first time in years. From WFAE in Charlotte, Scott Graff reports.
It's Sunday morning, and fans of the Carolina Panthers and Cincinnati Bengals tailgate in the shadows of Bank of America Stadium in downtown Charlotte. The game sold out just hours before a league-imposed deadline, but a lot of fans have decided to stay home. Among those who did show up are Larry Alderson and his friends from Wilmington, North Carolina. About a dozen guys, most of them sitting in folding chairs, eat chips and sip iced-down cans of beer. Alderson says some of his friends aren't here.
Well, our group, yeah, we usually have a lot more people be up here this weekend anyway, and we probably had five or six that just couldn't do it because they just didn't have the money, weren't working as much. They didn't make the trip with us.
A block away, a scalper who says his name is John Black stands on a corner. Black says business is slow. 2 weeks ago, he lost hundreds of dollars at the Panthers' home opener against Tampa Bay.
It was a flood of tickets. It was so many tickets out here, I went home with like eight tickets.
So what do you do in those situations? You just give them away, basically, when the game starts?
Cut my losses. I just took them home with me. I couldn't even give them away. It was so many tickets out here last week. Couldn't even give them away.
That game against the Buccaneers barely made it onto local TV. To encourage ticket sales, the NFL prohibits local broadcast of games that aren't sold out 72 hours before kickoff. Had there not been a sellout, it would have been the Panthers' first blackout since 2002, and three of the Panthers' six remaining home games are not sold out. 2 weeks ago, the San Diego Chargers suffered their first blackout in six seasons. Neither of Tampa Bay's 2010 home games have been on TV. In Detroit, where Lions fans haven't seen the team win a game on TV since 2007, a Week 2 blackout was avoided after the NFL gave the team a 24-hour extension to sell more tickets. League-wide, season ticket sales are down for the third straight year, perhaps due in part to the average NFL ticket cost, $76. That's 5% higher than last year. The NFL puts most of the blame on the economy. Brian McCarthy is a league spokesman.
The NFL is not immune. Our fans are struggling. Our business partners are also struggling. And it's our challenge to add value, be creative, and reach out and connect with our fans in many ways.
The league is still very popular, as evidenced by record TV ratings. And affordable high-definition TVs have made it easier to stay home and save money. But McCarthy says compared to the past, the current blackout situation is not a big deal. Even 15 years ago, it was common for 30% of NFL games to get blacked out over the course of the season. But that was before the NFL grew into the sports empire it is today. Just a few years ago, only 2% of NFL games were blacked out. Now that number is climbing.
Having the games on TV is important to developing your fan base.
Mackie Weaver is an executive with the Jacksonville Jaguars. That team had 7 of 8 home games blacked out last year.
I like to describe it as it's a 3-hour infomercial that promotes our product. And with that I'm not on, it definitely hurts the ability to build the brand.
The Jaguars are confident they fixed their problems by reaching out to the city's business community to help sell more tickets. Team officials with Carolina and San Diego declined to be interviewed for our story. But franchise's woes affect more than just the team. Jeff Arrowwood is the program director at the Fox affiliate in Charlotte, which carries Panthers games.
It's a major issue for us. The NFL games that we air are our most popular, our highest-rated programs, our most profitable programs. And when we are forced to black out a game, if we're forced to black out a game, we're going to be letting down a lot of fans, a lot of viewers, and a lot of money will be left on the table for us.
Arrowwood says ad revenue lost from a blacked-out game totals in the six figures. Restaurants and bars where fans gather to watch on TV also suffer. Calls have gotten louder for the NFL to relax the blackout rule. 3 weeks ago, Ohio Senator Sherrod Brown asked NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell to change the blackout policy so fans who are hurting financially could still see their favorite teams play. So, is the NFL willing to budge?
No.
Again, league spokesman Brian McCarthy.
The blackout policy has served the league very well for decades. This goes back to the 1970s, and we look at the blackout policy as not a short-term fix, but something that has benefited the league, has sold out stadiums over decades.
The number of blackouts last year was the highest in 5 seasons. Most of those blacked-out games came during the last half of the schedule. So with this year's pace already ahead of last year's, it looks like the situation will get worse before it gets better. For Only a Game, I'm Scott Graff in Charlotte.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. The races during January's summer meeting at Australia's Gold Coast Turf Club will not be limited to four-legged competitors. In a promotion that various groups throughout Australia have condemned as tacky at best, the track has invited up to 150 women to run a couple hundred meters along the track in their bikinis. Turf Club Chief Executive Grant Sheather has acknowledged that some may see the event as degrading, but he has also pointed out that Hollywood Park, the racetrack in Southern California, has been featuring the same sort of competition for years. So how could it be tacky and degrading? I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, the sports writing of John Lardner, recollected and recollected. But first, there now are more collegiate rifle teams for women than there are for men. Thus begins a recent Boston Globe story by John Powers on the ongoing impact of Title IX, the 1972 law designed to ensure that institutions receiving federal funds would equally distribute their opportunities to members of both genders. John Powers joins me now for a discussion of what Title IX has most recently wrought. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Hi, Bill. How are you?
Very good. Thank you. Let's begin with the point of view of the men's gymnastics coach at the University of Minnesota, Mike Burns. In speaking with you, he referred to what happens to college athletic departments each spring as, quote, the spring slaughter. What did he mean?
Well, basically, as schools are looking to the budget for the next academic year, and they are either out of compliance with Title IX regulations or they're losing money, which is much more likely these days, they look at the sports that don't make money and cost money, and gymnastics has been one of those. You're down to 16 teams nationwide. Economics are huge. It's a huge issue at almost every school, certainly state schools, but you still have to be in compliance with Title IX when you cut sports. So I think this is where the ADs are saying, well, how do we do one and the other? They make it come out even.
On which sports besides gymnastics has the impact of Title IX been most dramatic?
Well, basically, there are a number of endangered men's sports. Wrestling, for example, not that it's dying, but there used to be 400 wrestling teams in Division I in 1972. There are now 86. Fencing, skiing, water polo, rifle for men. These are all sports that have been dwindling and are considered, quote-unquote, endangered.
John, it's an old story that football is the sport that throws off the numbers. It's very expensive, and it loses money at most universities, and yet lots of places are adding football. Why?
Well, I think the idea is it is a way to get your school on the map. For example, a lot of people did not know until the football team beat Virginia Tech that James Madison was not a guy. It was, in fact, a college. They had to drop 10 teams, this is in 2006, to be in compliance with Title IX because they're a majority female school, 60% females. So I asked the AD there, I said, well, how about dropping football? He said, no, we could never do that. We are in Virginia. Everybody else has a team. And, oh, by the way, we just beat Virginia Tech last week. Everybody knows who we are now.
So people know who they are, but it's still probably costing them a lot of money to run the football program.
Well, and I think a lot of schools take it as a lost leader. For example, a school like Howard, which is two-thirds female to male, they have football because they want a reason for males to go to the school, not just to play the sport. It attracts donors, alumni interest. It galvanizes the student body. It makes the local area happy. And they are willing to do that, even though it is going to cost money.
How have the cuts in various sports affected the U.S. Olympic teams?
It's hurt a lot, especially, for example, gymnastics, wrestling. Most of the sports that are being cut are sports that are on the Olympic program. And there's only so much the U.S. Olympic Committee is able to do. There has been a task force that's kind of looking at it, a joint task force, but they're not really able to come up with much. No matter what they do, they can't help someone else's bottom line at a college.
Eric Pearson, the chairman of the College Sports Council, an advocacy group for men's sports, spoke to you about a so-called quota system being applied to men's teams. How does that work?
What they have, it's called roster management. And one thing that you do is you basically try to limit the number of men who can be on a roster while not limiting the number of women who can be on a roster. So they will do almost anything to keep a woman on a team, even if she's not playing. And they will not want to expand a men's team because it basically is a numbers game. And the one way that you can stay in compliance is to make sure that the proportion of males to females is roughly what it is in the student body. And these days, in many schools, for example, Texas is one of them, there are more women undergraduates than there are men.
So you have a men's baseball team with only three pitchers and they get exhausted, and you have a women's soccer team with 75 players, most of whom are on the bench.
That's right. And also, this is one reason why certain sports that you would think no one would want to add, like rowing, which is very expensive, is a great Title IX sport because it drives the number of women up. Hmm. You can counterbalance football with women's rowing. You can have 70 or 80 women out for rowing.
The president of USA Gymnastics, Steve Penny, blamed the economy rather than Title IX for the shrinking footprint of his sport. Has he got that right?
I think now he does. If you had asked that question maybe in 1995, probably not. But basically, the economy has hurt, especially state schools, which are looking at across-the-board cutbacks. University of California this week announced that they're going to be dropping 5 sports, including rugby, where they've won 25 national championships, and the sport goes back to 1882. They're not dropping it. They're going to make it a club sport. But men's and women's gymnastics are going. Baseball is going because the state of California is in terrible shape, and the universities have had a cutback.
You mentioned those University of California cuts, which, of course, were announced since your article appeared. Anybody else cutting things since the article came out?
No one since. We had heard that there might be a couple on the chopping block. And again, what is interesting about it is Cal had been talking about sports that might be on the chopping block. We had heard men's gymnastics was one of them. And, of course, the irony there is that the U.S. men's team is going to be at the World Championships next month. Of the 7 members, 2 are undergraduates at Cal. So it's not as though these teams have not been doing well. But when you get caught in a numbers crunch, gymnastics is a very easy sport to drop.
John, assuming the economy doesn't dramatically improve over the next little while and that Title IX remains intact, how is the college sports landscape likely to change in the immediate future?
Well, I think schools are usually given 2 options here. One is we either bleed everybody a little bit, or we find out the sports that are either expensive or don't bring in money, or which we just don't do very well at, and we drop them. For example, Northeastern dropped football this year. They were only drawing 2,000 people a game. They weren't doing very well. It was an easy cut. But generally, football is not dropped. Generally, football is added, which makes it even more difficult to be able to balance the budgets here.
John Powers writes about the Olympics and various other matters, including Title IX, for the Boston Globe, and he joins me here on Only a Game from time to time as well. John, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Of a prize fighter named Kid Broad, John Lardner once wrote, "The kid had a face only a mother could love, and even his mother managed to control her enthusiasm pretty well." That's one of the many memorable lines that's been made available again in the John Lardner Reader, a Press Box Legends classic sports writing. The editor of the book is John Shulian, who joins me now from KPCC in Pasadena. John, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you, Bill. It's good to be here.
You have called the first sentence of John Lardner's 1954 story about boxer Stanley Ketchel, quote, "the 25 most perfect words ever written in the name of journalism." So perhaps we had better begin there. Read those 25 words, please.
My pleasure. Stanley Ketchel was 24 years old when he was fatally shot in the back by the common law husband of the lady who was cooking his breakfast.
How do you suppose John Lardner avoided worrying that whatever he wrote next would screw up the lead?
Well, he had a lot of practice. He was a master of great leads, and somehow he always got you not just to the second paragraph or through it. He got you to the end. He was an amazing, pure, great writer.
Well, tell us a little bit about the author of those exceptional lines.
John Lardner was the son of Ring Lardner, the eldest son, one of 4 boys, all of whom pursued the writing life. John Lardner himself was a war correspondent in World War II. And as A.J. Liebling said, he was the bravest correspondent he ever saw, because when there was a bomb flash in the distance, Lardner would walk toward it to get a better look. Lardner wrote about the theater, and he was a TV critic. He could write about anything, obviously. But what he was first and foremost was a great sports writer in perhaps the golden age of sports writing. And by that I mean sports writing was taking a great turn in the middle of the 20th century. It was moving away from hacks who spewed cliches and kept a bottle in their bottom drawer, and took bribes from wrestling promoters. There weren't a great many great sports writers in that period, but the ones who were great were off the charts. And I'm speaking in particular of Red Smith, W.C. Hines, Jimmy Cannon, and John Lardner.
John Lardner began a story about Babe Herman for Sport magazine with another memorable lead paragraph. I wonder if you would favor us with that one as well.
Floyd Caves Herman, known as Babe, did not always catch fly balls on the top of his head, but he could do it in a pinch. He never tripled into a triple play, but he once doubled into a double play, which is the next best thing.
Do you think John Lardner had better subjects to write about than today's sports writers? I mean, Stanley Ketchel, Babe Herman, and then Casey Stengel and Satchel Paige and Walter Hagen and Titanic Thompson. The list goes on and on.
It was a looser time. There's so much at stake in sports today financially that looseness, that mischief, while it may still be there in private, is never on display publicly. Plus, you've got TMZ and Entertainment Tonight and rat-faced kids with cameras and their iPhones taking pictures of ballplayers in compromising situations. And it can't be. The world John Lardner wrote about simply is gone with the wind as all those wonderful Damon Runyon characters.
John, I've cherry-picked some of my favorite passages from the book. It's not perhaps entirely fair for me to be the only one doing that. Have you got a favorite?
Oh, let me turn to any random page, and I can probably find something that I really like. So much of what Lardner wrote was funny. Only rarely does he let melancholy slip into his work, or just a touch of the blues. And there's a wonderful column he wrote for Newsweek called No Scar, No Memory. And it begins this way. Chicago. An oddly shocking and confusing thing, neither good nor very bad, neither just nor very cruel, happened to Gene Fulmer, the young Mormon prize fighter, in the boxing hall here the other night. When he went into the ring, his life was at its peak. He was famous, newly rich, powerful, confident, rising. A few minutes later, he fell from power and glory to frustration and relative nothingness, and he cannot tell you of his own knowledge what happened. Not only power and glory are gone, the facts are missing too. 30 seconds of time at a climax of his existence are lost to him. To know what went on, he has to be told. To believe it, he has to look at a set of pictures. And this will be true for the rest of his life. It will be a strange, unsettling way to live. And the thrust of this is that Gene Fulmer got knocked out by Sugar Ray Robinson.
What do you think today's readers can learn from John Lardner's work?
I would hope they could see the heights to which sports writing can go. That they would appreciate the beauty of his sentences. You read these pieces he wrote, and they are so perfectly constructed. There's an economy of language. There's a beauty of language. The great wit. One thing I neglected to say earlier, what a quiet man Lardner was. We live in the noisiest era that I can imagine. Sports writers have certainly paraded in front of the camera. Some of them are quite wonderful, but a lot of other sports writers who appear regularly on camera shouldn't. And John Lardner was this incredibly quiet man. He probably had very dear friends who may not have heard him utter 10 sentences in their entire friendship.
I'm speaking with John Shulian, the editor of the John Lardner Reader, and you're listening to Only a Game. The evidence that John Lardner didn't take himself too seriously is everywhere in his work. In the middle of a story about battling Siki, another long-gone boxer, he writes, and I'm quoting now, In the unlikely event that you want to visit the scene of the murder 24 years ago of a man called Battling Siki, which is what I did one day recently for no useful reason, you will come across a few surviving landmarks. That, for no useful reason, is refreshing, isn't it?
Yes, we're in an age when people in the media seem to take themselves awfully seriously. The kind of sports column that John Lardner wrote, he spun yarns. He painted pictures of these great characters. He wasn't saying, look, you got to trade the shortstop. You know, the shortstop has lost range. You know, you got to fire the general manager. There was none of that. It was, these are games. Games are for fun. Come along and laugh with me.
This tone, for no useful reason and so on, is extraordinary given the physical difficulties John Lardner faced. Give us a sense of some of those challenges.
Oh, he had multiple sclerosis, heart trouble, tuberculosis. He was just afflicted from every direction, it seemed. One of the reasons that he's been forgotten, neglected for so long, is that he did himself the great disservice of dying a month before his 48th birthday in 1960. And there's a great story about his death. He was at home in his apartment in New York, and he had a heart attack. Somehow Lardner's personal physician made it to his side. And the physician is beside himself. He's saying, John, you can't die. You cannot die, John. You're a noble man. And Lardner looked up at him and said, oh, Lou, that sounds like a quotation. And then he died.
Oh, my goodness. John Shulian is the editor of the John Lardner Reader, A Press Box Legends Classic Sports Writing. The book is published by University of Nebraska Press, and John Shulian joined me from KPCC in Pasadena. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Bill, it's my pleasure. Take care.
It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Oliver Wyman, an international strategy consulting firm. With 3,000 professionals worldwide, Oliver Wyman serves global 1,000 companies. OliverWyman.com. And Nuance, offering Dragon speech recognition software for creating documents and emails and surfing the web all by speaking at nuance.com/NPR. This is NPR.
The winner of the Tour Championship in Atlanta last Sunday was PGA veteran Jim Furyk. The losers were all the sporting goods companies that have been trying to convince golfers to spend a lot of money on new high-tech custom clubs. Mr. Furyk realized $1.3 million for winning the event, which also put him over the top in terms of the FedEx Cup, meaning that he will soon be shipped a brown box containing another $10 million if it hasn't already arrived. The club with which Mr. Furyk tapped his way along the greens to said riches cost him $39 at a discount golf shop, which suggests that most, if not all, of the people who've been seeking to improve their games by purchasing high-end putters should check out Goodwill instead. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, we'll paint a picture of Tommy Heinsohn painting pictures. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill.
We don't know, of course, which two teams will be in the World Series yet.
Well, I do, but I'm not telling you.
But we learned this week that the third game of said series will start early enough so that children may actually be able to see the ninth inning. Has Major League Baseball forgotten how to maximize profits?
Well, I don't know if it's so children can see the later innings or older folks like us will be awake during the later
innings.
Well,
there's that, yes.
I mean, I'm not exactly sure which way they're going, but it's altogether a good thing.
On Sunday, the Texas Rangers celebrated clinching the American League West championship. Have you ever heard of a more careful celebrator than Texas outfielder Josh Hamilton?
Well, no, but I think his reasons for this were well taken. He's had a well-documented history of drug and alcohol problems. He avoided the traditional spraying of champagne and beer in the clubhouse because he thought it might be dangerous for him to be around it, and good for him.
And his teammates came after him looking to dump a barrel of water on him.
That's
which
right.
I thought was very good,
well,
but he avoided even that.
Well, didn't they used to throw people in the showers with their uniforms on? Wasn't that a big deal?
Yeah. I'm sure that you've seen the remarks this week by one LeBron James who believes that race, quote, played a factor in the public's negative reaction to the one-hour television special in which he thumbed his nose at the people of Cleveland. I think I'm just going to get out of the way while you respond to that.
Yeah, this is not going to end well for anybody. I think they're probably, if you went through the mail that LeBron James got when he went to Miami, you would certainly find that race is a factor. That being said, to throw this out there imprecisely, pretty much out of nowhere to CNN, does Maverick Carter and LeBron James's cause no good either?
Charlie, what exactly is the proposed new dress code in the National Basketball Association, and why is the Orlando Magic's Stan Van Gundy so enthusiastic about the possibility that it will be named after him?
Coaches have to wear collared shirts now. No more mock turtlenecks. No more pretending you're a member of the Strawberry Alarm Clock on the sideline.
Now, there's a reference that a few chosen listeners will get.
Most of them won't be able to stay awake during the late innings of the World Series
game. That's exactly
games.
Right.
As it's pointed out, though, by someone, it really should be called the Don Nelson rule because he was the first one to go to this style.
It has often been said that politics is the most important sport in Boston, but based on a decision made this week by the Boston Media Consortium, I wonder if we should reevaluate that claim.
Yeah, they moved the gubernatorial debate back one day so it won't conflict with the Boston Celtics season opener against the famous Miami Heat.
Mm-hmm.
So good for them.
So the most important sport is
basketball. Shaquille O'Neal.
Yeah. Nobody played pro football longer than George Blanda did, Charlie. He hung in for 26 seasons, and on Monday, Mr. Blanda died at the age of 83. Have you fond memories of the oldest of the old pros?
I have fond memories of him being the quarterback for the Houston Oilers back when the AFL was a truly renegade operation. I've never quite forgiven anyone for the merger that made it part of the corporate boring NFL. But what I remember about George Blanda is dropping back to throw the ball to Charlie Hennigan in Jeppesen Stadium, which was a stadium in name only, by the way.
My crack research team tells me that in the fourth week of the NFL season, the team with the best record in the NFC is the Chicago Bears. That can't be right.
The Bear Down Chicago Bears. They had a huge win on Monday night against the Packers. Defensively, they're coming around. They hired Mike Martz, the former coach of the St. Louis Rams, to work with their quarterback, Jay Cutler, who's having a terrific season so far. But it is primarily their defense winning games for them.
Charlie, the NFL has 6 black head coaches and 5 black general managers, and that's enough to have earned the league an A in hiring practices, according to the Institute for Diversity and Ethics in Sport. Do you suppose Major League Baseball and the NBA are gnashing their teeth?
Generally, the NFL lags behind in this sort of thing. This is the highest grade they've ever gotten, and good for them.
During training camp, Dallas Cowboys rookie Dez Bryant refused to carry the shoulder pads of veteran Roy Williams in some sort of rookie initiation. Given the size of the dinner bill that Mr. Bryant had to pay this week, don't you think Mr. Bryant perhaps wishes that he just picked up the shoulder pads?
Almost $55,000 worth of food for virtually the entire ball club and wives and apparently any hanger-on who happened to walk by Roy Williams the following week at a steakhouse. This is the kind of rookie hazing that's certainly better than the usual kind. But it's really not the kind of thing you want to do if you're entering into a labor action against a bunch of people who are going to declare you to be greedy.
I'm thinking the same thing. And I love the fact that some of his teammates not only ordered everything on the menu, they got expensive wine to go. You know, stuck it into their raincoat pockets and left with it.
Wine in a bag, exactly.
In a shocking development, the man who won the Tour de France tested positive for a performance-enhancing drug. The testee's explanation was, it's time for a little quiz here.
You said testes.
A, bad test. B, bad toothpaste. C, bad meat.
You got your steroids on my steak. No, you got your steak in my steroids. Yes, Alberto Contador has decided that the presence in his body of clenbuterol was a, quote, clear case of food contamination. The steak was brought across the border from Spain to France on a rest day. I mean, I find this enormously plausible.
Excellent. And finally, Charlie, I'm going to let you explain why people referring to the security guards at the Commonwealth Games as apes aren't insulting the guards.
Well, first of all, I'm loving the Commonwealth Games. Number one, they're allowing vuvuzelas. Mm-hmm. We spit on your silly Wimbledon, by the way. But apparently there have been rhesus monkeys running all over the athletes' quarters stealing stuff. So they've hired... Now, I have to get these species straight or else the monkey fans in our audience...
Hired is interesting here.
Yes. They hired gray langur monkeys, which apparently have a gang thing going against the wild rhesus monkeys, mm-hmm. to chase the rhesus monkeys away. Yeah. Aha, but this is not the most interesting animal-related thing involved in keeping the athletes safe at the Commonwealth Games. That would be a cobra, which was discovered in one of the athletes' rooms, has prompted the hiring of 50 traditional snake charmers to rid the athletes' quarters of cobras. One only hopes they're playing vuvuzelas.
Charlie Pierce is the author of Idiot America, among other things, and he joins me at this time each week. Charlie, thanks very much.
Thanks, Bill.
Last Saturday at the Melbourne Cricket Club, over 100,000 fans of Australian rules football gathered to watch the sport's grand final, which was supposed to end with the crowning of either St. Kilda or Collingwood as champion. But a funny thing happened on the way to the coronation. The game ended in a tie, and in this case, ended was ambiguous. According to the hallowed traditions of the AFL, which eschews overtime in the championship game, the contest would have to be played again. In the vernacular of the playground, last Saturday's result called for a do-over. In the 114-year history of Australian football, this has only happened twice before. Perhaps that's why nobody quite knew what to make of the circumstance, or rather, lots of people made of it lots of different things. Many players grumbled that the postponement of the off-season had screwed up their vacation plans. Collingwood captain Nick Maxwell called the additional game, quote, an absolute joke. But the owners of the two teams and the league's administrators were no doubt thrilled. Revenues from the do-over were estimated at $19 million. The windfall was no consolation to Laura Haywood and various other brides-to-be who knew that a lot of the people they wanted at their weddings would be watching football last Saturday and so had planned their nuptials for a week after the championship. Oops. It is probably impossible for fans of sports in the U.S. to imagine settling a championship by asking both teams to come back in a week and play it again. Extra innings and overtime are taken for granted by those who follow sports in this country. An aversion to ties has even been offered as one reason soccer lags behind the other pro sports in terms of attendance and TV viewership here. But what fun to discover something this quirky in the all-too-often buttoned-down and regimented business of our games. As Michael DeFabrizio, a blogger in Australia, wrote, "We're getting two grand finals in 1 year. How great is that?" I agree. Pretty great, but not quite great enough to keep the tradition alive, it turns out. It was determined after last week's tie that if St. Kilda and Collingwood couldn't settle the issue in regulation the second time around, there would be an overtime. Grand final, the sequel, began while I was asleep last night, and for the sake of all concerned, I hope it's over.
All the greatest golf a sight was tennis players too, are coming far from foreign lands, so why not you, the full and strong, along, make life a happy song, let's take a trip to Melbourne.
From 1957 through 1965, Tommy Heinsohn was a very good player on a great basketball team. The Boston Celtics won 7 consecutive championships during that stretch. Heinsohn became Boston's head coach in 1969, and over the next 8 years, the Celtics won 5 division titles and 2 more championships. Tommy Heinsohn was named to the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1986. All of which is beside the point with respect to the story I'm about to tell, because it's the story of Tommy Heinsohn the artist rather than Heinsohn the basketball player. We spoke recently at the Arsenal Center for the Arts in Watertown, Massachusetts, which currently features an exhibit of Tommy Heinsohn's paintings and drawings titled Beyond Basketball.
You know, this is what I was doing since I was a little kid, and at times basketball kind of took over my life so that I wasn't able to really do as much as I would have liked to have done.
Now, people aren't going to quite believe Tommy Heinsohn is saying basketball got in the way.
Well, it did.
To some extent, basketball continues to get in the way. Tommy Heinsohn still broadcasts some of the Celtics games on a local cable channel, But throughout his career as a player, coach, and analyst, the artist has found a way to paint. The current show includes scenes that presented themselves to Heinsohn as he looked out the windows of hotels in various NBA cities, though lately he seems to have preferred to work in New England.
This one right here is the lighthouse on Pumpkin Island up in Maine. Mm-hmm. It was on the cover of the invitation that went out. It was a very overcast day, as you can see. And in fact, the whole week we were up there in that area, there wasn't a sunny day. So I got pretty good at painting moody clouds.
He's also gotten pretty good at painting lots of other things. Plenty of his work was selling, even as we spoke. According to Allison Matthews, who was handling sales at the exhibition, she maintained that both the quality of the art and the personality of the artist were responsible.
Oh, yes, absolutely. He's got a story for every painting, too, which helps, I think. There's a personal story to everything, so.
For Heinsohn, the basketball-playing artist, or painting former pro player, there have always been personal stories. One of his favorites speaks to how he handled the challenge of indulging his passion for painting while he was scoring for the Celtics.
I wanted to go to the Cochrane Galleries down in Washington. It's a terrific museum. And I asked a couple of guys at breakfast if they want to go with me, and nobody wanted to go. And I hopped a cab, took off. And the cab driver dropped me off at the wrong entrance, so I had to walk around the building. And as I walk around the building, I look down the basement window, and I have a life class with a nude model standing in the window. So when I went back to the hotel, talked to my teammates and told them this thing, they all were going to become art lovers real quick.
But seriously, folks, according to the artist, the gap between painting and basketball, or sports in general, is not as wide as might be supposed. According to Tommy Heinsohn, each requires concentration and practice. But what's most important is that the artist and the athlete must love what they do. And then there's the matter of confidence, which, as a shooter, Tommy Heinsohn never lacked.
You got to learn that if you're going to take the last shot at a game, it's either going to go in or it's not going to go in. And you're either going to be the hero or the goat. So if you think every painting is going to be a masterpiece, all you have to do is harken back to taking the last shot at a game. So it becomes immaterial. It becomes, you know, what you do, if you execute the best way you knew how, that's all you can do.
What about the percentages?
Well, a masterpiece is judged by other people. The difference between art and sports, basketball, is that you know the results and people's opinions within an hour after the game. You may never know. Look at Van Gogh. During his lifetime, he sold one painting, and I think it was to his brother. So you got to go along on what you believe. But you got to have a little moxie, too, which is what Van Gogh had. And he's the type of guy that would be willing to take the last shot of a game.
Van Gogh puts it up.
Last shot by Van Gogh. Give him three!
That dramatic metaphor notwithstanding, what seemed to impress most of the visitors to the Arsenal Center Gallery on this particular evening was the serenity conveyed by the paintings. Most of the landscapes were devoid of people. Several of those observing the work spoke of the delicate shading of the various greens of the sea, or the play of light and shadow on the sun-bleached wooden buildings Heinsohn had rendered. The comments of Carol Barton, a visitor to the exhibition on a coastal scene, were representative.
Very relaxing, soothing. I like it. Oh, looks like it sold, though.
I'm sorry, this one's already gone.
Maybe he'll do another one.
All the praise and sales suggested that most of those in attendance were happy they'd taken advantage of the opportunity to see Tommy Heinsohn's work, but I couldn't help wondering if a similar exhibition by a similarly talented and committed artist would have drawn the same level of interest. I asked Bob Shea, a member of the board of the Arsenal Center for the Arts, if the artist's celebrity had influenced the board's decision to mount the exhibition.
You know, it's a difficult question. You know, it has to meet a certain standard, doesn't matter who it is. You go upstairs, and there are artists who aren't as widely known as Tommy.
Artists who aren't in the Basketball Hall of Fame.
That's right. That's right.
For the record, in the Arsenal Center exhibition, there's not a single painting in which a basketball or a basketball player makes an appearance. Nevertheless, as Bob Shea and I spoke, more red dots were appearing on the paintings around us. Informed of that development, the artist expressed satisfaction.
Well, that's good. That's good. Well, this, you know, this is for a scholarship fund for in my wife's name for an artist here. And hope they all sell.
No surprise, right?
No. Well, I don't know about that.
He doesn't know about that. And so the fellow known to his Celtics teammates as Tommy Gunn, because he was never, ever shy about hoisting up the last shot, or the first shot, or any shot in between, embraces modesty regarding his canvases. He is not only a man of multiple passions, this large and loud champion who paints tranquil scenes and still lifes, but a fellow who will surprise you as well. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati. Jack Flagler is our intern, and we had help this week from Tony Federico at KPCC in Pasadena. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To view our photo gallery, subscribe to the Only a Game podcast, and listen to archived chosen stories, please visit our website, onlyagame.org. You can follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Only a Game Radio. Our final word this week comes from, who else, Tommy Heinsohn, who describes how he managed to paint while on the road with the Celtics.
I've been painting out of hotel windows for years, unless there's a brick wall by my window, in which case I order room service to do a still life.
I've seen those still lifes, usually flowers, fruit, gourds, and basketballs. Pretty nice. Bill Littlefield, thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support comes from LendingTree, providing up to 4 loan offers from a network of lenders. Learn more at LendingTree.com or 800-555-TREE. The John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. And the George Lucas Educational Foundation, creator of Edutopia, a source for what works in education. Learn more at edutopia.org. This is NPR.